91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour we discuss the way teachers are trained. Do great teachers have a natural charisma, or can the gift of teaching be taught to the millions in the workforce? Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Can teachers learn to teach through systemization? That's quite effective in Japan. What does it take for a teacher to be effective in inner city classrooms? And how should schools evaluate teachers? A stimulating hour ahead with education writer Elizabeth Green. She's the author of Building a Better Teacher, How Teaching Works and How to Teach It to Everyone. That's next after NPR and regional news. And it is today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, August 24th, Bonnie, the beginning of school. Remember those days?
I remember those days.
First day of school back.
Seems like yesterday.
Yeah. You enjoyed it and I hated it.
Well, today's a great day to look at teaching and teachers, what we're doing right and where we're lacking.
Of course. Most everyone is blessed by a favorite teacher or two who really strike a chord of motivation and learning. But what spawns that ability to teach? Are great teachers born, or are they taught such an exceptional craft?
Or is it both? We're now joined by veteran education journalist Elizabeth Green. We'll discuss her new book, Building a Better Teacher, How Teaching Works and How to Teach It to Everyone. And she joins us from NPR in New York. Welcome to you, Elizabeth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. The subtitle of your book infers that anyone can become a good teacher, and we often think of it as an innate skill. Either you have it or you don't. So why do you call that the myth of the natural-born teacher?
Yeah, so there's been in the last several decades a lot of research into what makes someone excellent at the craft of helping children learn to know things or do things. And what the research shows is that you cannot attribute excellent teaching to any single personality trait or even to intelligence. What seems to matter much more is what the teacher does once he or she is in the classroom and then what the teacher knows. And that's important because rather than being about personality, teaching turns out to require specialized skill. So that's really important to keep in mind when we think about how do we ensure that all kids can learn. We can't just bank on people, finding the right people to teach. We also have to figure out ways to help them learn to teach on the job and before they get to the classroom.
Well, just thinking about the sheer numbers of teachers and the sheer numbers of new teachers that are hired each year, it's really a lot to expect that people are just going to have innate abilities and be able to teach the millions of kids.
Exactly. And, you know, sometimes we think, well, you're right. You know, teachers do need to have at least the subject matter that they're teaching. But in fact, it goes beyond that. So if you think about what is a teacher doing in the classroom, a teacher has to know not just the right answers to the material they're teaching, but the teacher also has to know the answers that the students are likely to get wrong. And then they have to look at those wrong answers and be able to diagnose the underlying misunderstanding and then correct that. So, for example, when a teacher is teaching something basic, like teaching small children how to read English, the teacher can't just know how to read English herself and be fluent English reader. She has to know the different ways that vowels combine together and make different sounds that once we're an expert at something, we really forget. But when we're a beginner, like students are, we have to learn from the beginning. The same with math. A teacher can't just know how to do multiplication of a two two-digit number by a one-digit number, she has to know why students are likely to make certain systematic errors and then be able to say, oh, that's because they don't understand place value, and then know not only what that means, but how to correct it. So there's quite a lot of specialized knowledge and skill that's absolutely essential for teachers to thrive and for students to thrive.
Elizabeth, this book began as a New York Times Magazine assignment. What were you to write about? What was the assignment?
Oh, that's a great question. I'd been covering education for a long time, and the Times Magazine assumed that I would know something about this new buzzword that was appearing in, you know, all states across the country, really, and policy papers about how to improve schools. And the term was teacher quality. And the reason that term was getting attention is that in new research was showing that of all the variables that affect student achievement, of the ones that are under our control, huge caveat, because there's lots of variables that students bring to them from their family and from their demographic background that they cannot control and that schools cannot control. But of the variables that schools control, teacher quality is more important than the number of students in the classroom, than the amount of funding that the school gets, than all kinds of other variables. And that was the assignment I was given was explain what that means. What is the implication of this finding? And then what does make a good teacher?
And reading your book over the weekend, I was amazed, or I was very struck by just thinking, I wouldn't begin to know how to teach someone to read. And
yes.
How difficult that must be.
And think about how essential that is, especially as our student population becomes more and more diverse. There's a lot of students who come to this country, not just as at the age at which most students at standard begin to read English, but older students who do not speak English as a first language and need to learn a new language. Teaching reading is really complicated. Think about why is it that the letters E and A and that combination sound completely different in the same word, read. How can it, or read, mm-hmm. How can you teach a student to recognize these patterns in language and really learn to read? It's doable. In fact, there's many patterns that teachers can use to both assess what their students do and do not understand and then move from there. There are curriculum materials that they can take advantage of. But what really matters is not just all these materials, but what the teacher does in the moment when a student makes a mistake and there's 30 students in front of her, and she has to figure out how does she correct the mistake in the moment so that not only the student who made the mistake will understand what she did wrong, but all of her classmates will also understand and everyone will feel respected, safe. This is complex works. It's doable, but it's complex, and teachers need really significant preparation before they enter the classroom and then supports while they're in the classroom, if there are, to succeed.
You know, before we get to this craft and what you call a complicated science of teaching, and this does seem like an overwhelming thing that maybe we're asking too much, but you say that most teachers feel unprepared in America when questioned, that they feel unprepared when they get into the classroom.
Survey after survey, and that's over a trend that persists over decades, finds that teachers enter the classroom feeling overwhelmed by the task at hand. I mean, there aren't that many professions in which we ask beginners to do the exact same task that we also ask of veterans. So if you enter, for example, our field, if you enter the field of journalism, on day one as a reporter, you're supported by your senior colleagues to figure out what you're doing on the job. You have more intense editing. That's just not likely to be the case in teaching. You're going to teach fourth grade today and be responsible for not just all of your interactions with the students, but deciding what lesson plans to use, deciding what curriculum materials to use, in some cases even drafting your own assessments. And you're going to ask the same 25 years down the road. Your job won't be any different.
What about the effects of Common Core, though? Doesn't that make everybody a new teacher now?
That's an interesting that you say that. I mean, one of the puzzles behind this variable of teacher quality is, well, if that's the thing that really makes the difference, then isn't the way to solve our education problems to get better teachers? But the more I dug into the problem of why do teachers struggle, why do they feel systematically underprepared, I realized that at the root of that problem is actually something broader. That's the fact that we have a completely fractured governance structure in American education that means that teachers have commands from dozens of different bodies. So the federal government says one set of expectations. The state government has another set of expectations. Then the local school district may be governed by someone with completely different idea, and the principal may even have a different idea than that. And that's not to mention the people who write the textbooks, the people who write the assessments, and the people who write the curriculum materials, the actual worksheets that students do in school. So all of these are sending different messages to teachers. They should be there to support teachers. They should be there just like the teacher, and I didn't even mention teacher preparation programs. They might say the purpose of teaching is to help prepare students to be social justice warriors, whereas the federal government says the purpose of teaching is to help students be better citizens or better participants in the economy. These are messages that cross purpose. And so all of the things that the teacher should use to support her to solve these minute-by-minute problems instead are at odds, and they leave teachers even more isolated and even more less prepared to do the difficult and important work in front of them. And so what that means is that what we actually need in American education is more simplicity, just a radical simplicity, so that all these different pieces actually speak the same language, so that a teacher comes out of teacher preparation program able to use the same curriculum she will be using in the school district, working with assessments that the school district also works with, having learning goals for her students in mind that are the same that the state is expecting of her. And so if you actually could have those clear marching orders, then we could have teachers could have a lot more certainty about what to do. And the Common Core standards were designed to help to solve that problem, to say, what if we all got on the same page? What if teacher preparation programs prepared teachers to teach to one set of learning goals for students? What if assessments also lined up to those learning goals? And what if the states also could be on board? That's what the Common Core standards are attempting to do.
Elizabeth Green, why do so many efforts to improve teaching methods wind up failing? In the book, you talk about efforts at Michigan State and California that were very ambitious but failed.
Yes, and those stories are extremely relevant as we think about the Common Core standards, too. So in this country, we do not have any shortage of great dreams about how our schools could improve. We have many educators with incredible visions for how schools could be designed better, how students could learn more ambitious things, like not just learn to memorize math facts or not just learn to diagram sentences, but actually think about big ideas in literature. Literature and math and science and history. There's no shortage of these kinds of ideas, but because we have not treated teaching like it requires specialized knowledge and skill, when we try to implement these grand visions at scale, they tend to vanish once they reach the teachers in the classrooms and the students in the classrooms. And that's because it's not a simple thing to help students wrestle with big ideas. Teachers need more supports. They cannot do this on their own. And yet we leave these mandates, we land down these mandates on teachers' desks with absolutely no support, on top of a broken system that has conflicting messages. And so we often get more chaos than success.
Well, lots more to talk about with journalist and author Elizabeth Green. She's written Building a Better Teacher, How Teaching Works and How to Teach It to Everyone. A short break, and we'll be right back.
And 21 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with education journalist Elizabeth Green. We're talking about her book, Building a Better Teacher, How Teaching Works and How to Teach It to Everyone. And the book has just recently been released in paperback. Elizabeth Green is also the co-founder of Chalkbeat New York. Briefly, what is that, Elizabeth?
Chalkbeat is a news organization. We have reporters in four locations around the country, and they tell daily stories of educational change efforts, efforts to improve our public schools.
Well, we'll get more in that. You know, when you were talking before our break about, you know, the position really or the predicament teachers find themselves in, I was thinking that also generally teachers really have never been held in high esteem or garnered the respect or attention that some other professions have. Isn't that part of the issue?
I absolutely think that's part of the issue. I think that the way that the American public views teaching has a really interesting dichotomy that has been here, I learned, from the very beginning. So back in the earliest days of American schooling, you know, just post-colonial days, the school teacher would be both highly regarded and highly disrespected. And that was symbolized in the fact that school teachers would sit in the sort of first row of chapel, the first few rows of chapel in the public square of the chapel in early America. But the teacher was also paradoxically the person expected to sweep up after services. Mm. So I think that that dichotomy still lives within this profession. We both idolize teachers and we say thank a teacher and teacher gratitude day. We show up for school with a lot of hope for what teachers can do for our kids. But we also routinely disrespect teachers. We look at their work as just work helping little children and sitting on rugs and maybe physically tiring but not intellectually engaging. And I think one of the reasons that we have this tension is that we both really value education. We believe education is the key to better economic future, better democracy. And yet, we don't understand what education actually takes. So we don't understand and don't really wrestle with the fact that if you're in front of a group of 30 children, it's actually a more complex situation than a doctor would find, except as one of the characters in my book says, except in the case of an emergency room doctor working in the middle of a natural disaster. Mm. Because teachers have 30 patients at once, simultaneously. They have to think about 30 misunderstandings in these children's heads, and they have to simultaneously operate on those misunderstandings. If we really want children to be armed with the ability to think critically, to read well and read beneath the surface, to do computations that go beyond memorization but make meaning of math in the way that our new quantitative society demands, teachers have to do this work very effectively. And if we're ever going to advance our education system, we have to change the way we think about teaching.
If you'd like to join in the conversation with journalist and author Elizabeth Green, what do you think makes a good teacher? Do you agree that anyone can become a good teacher? And how did a great teacher change your life for better or worse? 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio@wlrn.org, radio@wlrn.org.
Elizabeth, you spend quite a bit of time in the book talking about the Japanese and their educational system. And ironically, the Japanese adapted American progressive thinking to reform their schools. Tell us about that.
Yes. So I said that America is a great producer of ideas about how to improve schools, but not a great implementer of those ideas. And it turns out that the same ideas that we produced about, especially about how to improve our math education system, were actually adopted unsuccessfully here, but successfully in Japan. And so that was a real puzzle to me. How did that happen? Researchers uncovered this paradox when a study was done in the 90s looking inside high schools in three countries. This was right after a round of ambitious reforms to the American math curriculum and the way teachers were supposed to teach math. So one of the goals of this study was to videotape high school and middle school classrooms in these three countries, eighth grade classrooms, actually, and see, were these reforms carried out in the American schools, and how did that compare to other schools? And what the researchers found was that American teachers were unfortunately not teaching in the ways that they had been asked to change, but another country's teachers were, and that country was Japan. So this was a great mystery that I was eager to unravel.
And what did you find?
Yeah, so what I found is that fundamentally the Japanese treat teaching differently than we do, and they have for a while. They treat it like a specialized set of knowledge and skills, like a science. For one thing, their lessons often happen in public, whereas the American school teacher operates in isolation, without anyone watching her work, without any colleagues to discuss her work with. Japanese teaching, on the other hand, is a public act and seen as a public good. So teachers will actually teach lessons in front of the colleagues, not only in their own school building, but colleagues from across the school district and in some cases all around the country. Public lessons have attracted as many as 1,000 observers. And the reason they do this is that teachers in Japan believe they can only improve by looking at the insides of the work of teaching and learning, really studying their work. So after these public lessons, everyone comes together to discuss what happened. What happened when the student didn't know, you know, and I'm making up this case to switch to an American context, but didn't understand why E followed by A sounds different in one word than another. Why didn't the student understand, and what did the teacher do to respond to that move that was effective or ineffective? And so by having these public lessons and then studying how teaching works, the Japanese teachers have developed this very technical language to describe the craft of teaching, and it allows them to innovate much more quickly than the American teacher, who still remains trapped in what John Dewey described almost 100 years ago as this curse in which great ideas in American classrooms are born and die with the teacher who invented them. In Japan, because they're teaching in public in this way and treating teaching like a science that should be shared, a great idea is born, and the next day someone else is going to see it and it spreads. Hmm. So they just are able to improve much more quickly. So when interesting new ideas about what teaching and learning can look like come along in Japan, they have this already set up machinery of teachers working together to learn that quickly allows those ideas to get implemented.
Tell us about the Japanese observer that came to an American school, and while he was observing a video of a classroom, overheard the PA in the background.
Yes. So in that same study that I mentioned, where researchers compared schools in the U.S. and schools in Japan, a group of Japanese and American researchers were watching these videos together, and they were watching an American lesson. And the Japanese researchers kept saying, "What just happened? What just happened? Stop the tape. Something really strange just happened." And the U.S. researchers said, "I don't know what you're talking about. Like, keep going. That was just the PA system." So what had happened was the public address system had interrupted a lesson, and some announcement had made, I think, about bus schedules, right? We can all remember being either in the classroom of our own kids or our own classrooms. This is a constant, such a constant of American classrooms that, just like those American researchers, probably most of us have stopped paying attention to it. But in Japan, it was a really important event, very unusual event. Why had the lesson been interrupted? That does not happen in Japan. Lessons are sacred. They are a time where teachers have a lot of work to do to help students learn in a limited amount of time, and nothing will interrupt that, short of, you know, some kind of criminal incident or violent incident, and certainly not a bus scheduling change.
You know, I was thinking as I was reading that, well, this must be about time and money, but then I read that although American teachers spend twice as much time with their students, they're outperformed still by the Japanese, the Finnish. So how do we account for that? Where's all that time going that could be spent in other ways?
Yeah, so time is a really important variable to think about. So let's go back to why I emphasize this myth of the natural born teacher. The reason I emphasize this is because of the, if you start with that assumption that teachers just need to sort of show up and be really themselves, and by being themselves and authentically a great teacher that who has this innate ability, they will just connect with the students and the students will magically learn. Well, if you start with that assumption, then how would you budget a teacher's time in a day? Well, you would allocate all of a teacher's time that you could to working with students. But if you adjust that assumption to the accurate reality that, no, teaching is not something anyone is born knowing how to do, in fact, teaching is a skill that we all have to learn over time, then you would budget a teacher's time differently. You would say, actually, I want the teacher to spend a significant portion of his time studying the craft of teaching, studying colleagues and their lessons, studying the curriculum, working on his planning, and thinking about what his students in this year do and do not understand. Well, in Japan, in Finland, in other countries that outperform us academically, that is the way a teacher's time is budgeted. But in the U.S., we budget almost all of a teacher's time just standing in front of students. So that means that teachers who are really effective in this country, they have to do all of the planning and thinking and studying and working with colleagues work that that requires on their own time when, you know, they should be maybe having dinner with their family or sleeping or going on vacation. Instead, they are using their own budget, their own time to learn to teach. And it's really no wonder that we struggle. We're asking teachers to do something impossible in an impossible constraint.
Well, we hope by the end of the program you have some good advice and ways we can rectify this, Elizabeth. We're speaking with author and
There is plenty of ways, reasons to be optimistic.
Okay,
yes.
Good. Journalist and author Elizabeth Green has written Building a Better Teacher, How Teaching Works, and How to Teach It to Everyone. Another short break. We'll be right back.
And we're back. It's today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Building a Better Teacher, How Teaching Works, and How to Teach It to Everyone. That's the title of Elizabeth Green's latest book. And Elizabeth, based on what you were saying before about how closely we need to be training teachers, now we have a caller or an emailer who wants to know about homeschooling, considering that and how you describe how professionals teachers must be trained.
Yeah, it's a good question. Given what I'm saying, I think the clear implication is that the best situation for children is for them to be in a setting that has been really designed carefully. What teachers do is they build learning environments, and that's something that we ask them to do on their own, but which ideally is done within the context of a system of strong supports that are all pushing them in the same direction. So given that, I think some homeschooling contexts really do work to build systems of their own, shadow school systems, where it's not just an individual parent working with her children or his children. It's a group of parents marshaling their resources together to create almost a shadow system. And that can be most effective, just as the school system can be most effective when, again, those conditions are in place where it's not an individual person alone expected to instruct, but rather the system is supporting her or him.
Again, if you'd like to join in, we do have some emails and some phone calls that we're going to get to. Our number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. Email is radio@wlrn.org. What was your favorite teacher like? You can let us know. We have an emailer. Elizabeth, I read your book with great interest. The company I work for, Learning Sciences International, is partnering, if my email will work. One second. You want to take that call?
I've got a call we can take, sure. This is Charles in Fort Lauderdale. Hey there. Charles,
Hi.
You're up.
Hi, fine. I just simply want to remark, because it's very difficult to get into the program, but in 1956, when I was in sixth grade, I was in an altercation with, I guess we could say the word would be African-American, and the two of us were pulled apart by a teacher. And after we did our detention, we were both given a lesson. My lesson was to read a book. It was written by Sinclair Lewis, published in 1938, called King's Blood Royal. And it's an excellent book about a white family in a small town that found out that they were like 1/64th African-American, and how the family divided over that. Part of the family became part of the black community, part became the white community. But it left such an impression on me, and the fact that I was made to read this book, and since then I have read a novel a week, every day since the summer of 1956. And this teacher is now retired, living in upstate Florida in Crystal River. I've reconnected. This woman did so much for me by opening my eyes to literature. I can't explain. That's so much better than anything I ever learned in college or in any other further education.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Thank her.
Elizabeth, any comment?
I love that story, because I think it captures what is very important about teaching, which is that there is this big push to measure the effects of teaching. And I think that often comes from a good place. We heard in the news broadcast before the program began that teachers in Florida are, of course, being evaluated for their success at helping students learn. And we couldn't know the difference between, or we couldn't even begin to discuss the difference between effective and ineffective teachers if we made no efforts to measure what they do. But in some ways, at the same time as that is true, the effects of a teacher are over such long time periods, and in some ways not captured by the metrics that we have at our available to us. Teachers really can change your quality of life. If a teacher unlocks a life of the mind for students, how do you measure that? But the effect for those students can last a lifetime.
Elizabeth, because you study this so closely, what universities do have the best schools of education?
Oh, that's a good question. There's lots of interesting innovation happening all around the country, both in university settings and outside of university settings, where teacher educators are trying to change the way teacher education programs work. So the basic challenge they face is that for many years, universities have not respected the work of teaching either, just as school districts have not. And so the people who educate teachers have the lowest prestige jobs, the lowest salaries, and do not usually have the right preparation themselves, the right familiarity with the craft of teaching, even to begin facing up to the challenge of their work. So what is being attempted at change is more investment in elevating the work of teacher education so that it becomes the most important thing at the university's education program, rather than the last thing on the plate after everything else, which is more prestigious, such as studying the history of education or the economics of education or the politics of education. Well, what about the science of teaching? Mm-hmm. They're elevating that. So, for example, the University of Washington has teacher educators who are doing pilot programs where they actually embed with classroom teachers so that the classroom teacher and the teacher educator have a group of future teachers observing the work in an actual classroom. And teacher educators will even say, pause during the actual teaching of a lesson. The students will pause, the teachers will pause, and the future teachers will discuss what they saw happen. And they will learn in these pause moments. So what that program is doing that other programs are doing that's effective, again, is treating teaching like a science and opening it up for future teachers to see all the invisible pieces of the work that teachers do so they can learn to do it themselves.
Okay, this is an email from Gail. I read your book with great interest. The company I work for, Learning Sciences International, is partnering with Palm Beach County School District to create demonstration schools to support teachers to create exactly the kinds of classrooms you're describing. The initiative was launched last year with 5 schools. Many additional schools are being added for the 2015-2016 school year. I'd love to discuss this initiative with you or invite you to tour the schools we're partnered with. And thanks for your great work. It's truly inspiring. So I suppose, what is your email? Elizabeth?
My email address is on my website, which is buildingabetterteacher.com. So there's contact information for me is
okay,
there.
Okay, great.
And we'll move along with some calls. This is Eugene in Boynton
yes,
Beach.
I have a very interesting story. In 1963, I graduated college and was looking for a job. All of a sudden, on a TV set, the Board of Education of the City of New York saying, if you graduated college, we will let you teach, even if you don't have any education courses, and they will give you a long time. So I started teaching without any education courses, without any teacher training, nothing. I went into the classroom with nothing. And I had to learn on my own. And then, that's one thing. And then let me talk about, they came out with the curriculum, the new math. Okay.
Right.
They only spent $1 trillion for books and this and that. And I'm putting an example on the board using the new math. A boy, and I remember his name, Danny Blanchard, raises his hand and says, Mr. Fine, it's easier the old way. Okay? What can I tell you? Now, discipline. How did I handle discipline? One day, a boy was playing with a yo-yo. Obviously, he shouldn't have. I wasn't going to yell at him, send a note home. I said to the boy, to the class, I was a yo-yo champ, which is true. So they gave me the yo-yo, and they sort of looked at me and said, yeah. I took the yo-yo, and I started to make a certain knot that you must make on the string. And when they saw that, all of a sudden, they kept quiet. I started doing some tricks. They were very impressed. I took the yo-yo off, gave it back to him, and I said, I appreciate it very much.
Eugene, let me interrupt just a minute. Elizabeth, you do spend a lot of time about maintaining discipline without being too intrusive to the topics.
That's nothing. I'm saying basically I started teaching with no training whatsoever.
Well, thank you, Eugene. Let's see what Elizabeth has to say.
Yeah, I think that story is too common. Teachers really can enter classrooms in cases where there are shortage situations with an emergency certificate that allows them to teach without any preparation at all. And just you mentioned discipline, so I think that's a good example. Not only do teachers have to teach students to understand the subject that the teacher is teaching, whether that's art or history or science or math or English, but they also have to teach students to be mature humans who interact in the world with other humans in responsible ways and ethical ways. And they have to deal with constant challenges of the interpersonal business that we call school discipline, but that includes so much more. So, you know, what do you do if a student shouts out? How do you get students to be quiet? All of this requires just as much training, thoughtfulness as teaching a subject. And, you know, it's also just as often counterintuitive as teaching math. So, for example, a teacher, to quiet a classroom down, the conventional adult response is to tell the students to shh, right? We like put our finger over our lips and we say shh. But when you study teaching, as the people I write about in my book do, you realize that shh is actually, while the most common response, a very ambiguous one for students. What are you asking the students to do? Are you asking them to stop talking, or are you asking them to just speak more quietly? Mm-hmm. That's what the story of one of the characters I write about, Doug Lamov, as he goes on this journey of studying what the best teachers do, both to teach subject matter, but also to teach kids to interact with each other effectively. And instead, what most effective teachers do is they give extremely explicit directions, the kind that would be just socially inappropriate in an adult setting, but which actually are effective with children. So getting learning these lessons is something that nobody should be expected to do on his own, and marshaling all the creative skills like his yo-yo expertise is what teachers are left to do, is just use their own wits. But that's not very effective, right? It's the same conundrum John Dewey said. Eugene shouldn't have to invent all his great ideas ideas on his own and then have them die with him. He should be able to take stand on the shoulders of those who came before and then pass on what he learns to those who come next.
Elizabeth, you mentioned Doug Lamov. You talk about him, that former principal. Talk about his taxonomy of good teaching.
Yeah, so the educator that I just mentioned, he decided to go on a journey where he would find the greatest teachers he could, videotape what they did, and then watch all the videotapes in the same manner that a great quarterback coach might study videos of effective quarterbacks in football plays. So he studies these teaching videos, and he realizes that there's an incredible wealth of specialized skill hidden in what seemed like charisma. But in fact, what teachers were doing were a set of techniques that anyone could replicate, that anyone could learn to do. So even something like having the demeanor that allows a person to walk into a room and just sort of by standing there cause children to be quiet turned out to be a technique. Some people maybe had it more an intuition about how to do it than others, but anyone could learn. So it involved putting your shoulders in a certain way, looking at students in a certain way, speaking in very specific directions, identifying patterns of behavior that were positive that you wanted other students to replicate, and by rewarding the positive, encouraging other students to do it. So he ended up publishing this set of techniques in first just a Word document with some videos attached, and it became, this is Doug Lamov after studying his videos, the techniques became this underground sensation. Teachers would read them and say, I've been waiting for someone to help write all of this down. And what emerged was a new language to describe the science of teaching that was just much more micro and helpful to these teachers. They would watch like a 2-minute clip or less, and from that 2 minutes they could focus in on the exact technique that they wanted to learn.
Really interesting. Well, we have an emailer, Gabby. I was so incredibly fortunate to have excellent teachers throughout my schooling, and one of them, Mrs. Tamara Shane from Coral Glades High School, encouraged me to become a teacher myself. I took it to heart and have undertaken education as my career. However, at every stage in my undergraduate years, professors have tried to steer me elsewhere. They've told me that the best and brightest are not attracted to teaching and that it will not serve me well. How do you feel about this schism that I have encountered between teachers and professors? How can we train new teachers and attract people to the field when this schism exists? Good question.
Yes. What is the name of the...
Gabby. Gabriella.
Gabby. Gabriella, I think that I'm so glad that you're persisting against those myths about teaching, because teachers have an incredible impact, and we should absolutely recognize that teaching requires the skills that any other very, very challenging and intellectual profession requires, and we're going to have to change the way we as a country talk about teaching, think about teaching, and understand teaching so that we can stop preventing great people from going into the field.
And we'll go back to our calls. This is Chris in Wellington. Hi there.
Hi, Joseph. Thanks for taking my call.
Welcome.
I want to go back to the part of the discussion where Elizabeth was talking about the amount of time that should be devoted in the classroom to training and collaboration versus actual student instruction. And it just seems to me like over and over again, it comes down to a question of resources. And not to even generalize with that term, but how much money do we spend on teaching itself? I'm sure you've had a lot of episodes discussing the class size amendment and all the various ways that's been subverted by the legislature in the state of Florida. My daughter just finished graduate school last year after teaching for a couple of years in college as a graduate assistant teaching languages. She graduated as a linguist, and she's now teaching Spanish in high school. in a fairly sort of typical lower tier district with, you know, lots of disadvantaged students. And she's got seven classes a day of 40 kids. And, you know, to me, it's just absolutely, it's amazing that we can have any expectations whatsoever for the performance of that classroom, even if it was the greatest teacher that ever walked in there in front of those kids, much less a beginner just trying to get her feet in the profession. So, you know, I just think it comes down to the amount of importance we place on our kids and how much money we're willing to spend or not.
Elizabeth?
It's a universal need.
Yeah.
So I think one of the many, many paradoxes of the last 25, 30 years of American public education is that there has actually been a pretty widespread recognition that we were underinvesting in public education, especially in certain communities. And then there have been subsequent increases in our investment. And while there's still incredible challenges, we have seen resources across the board rise, and yet the outcome that we expected from that increased investment has not followed. So the puzzle is why? Why did that happen? And I think one of the answers is we put the resources in the wrong places. And we really do have to think not just about the bottom line amount of investment, but where that spending is going. So I've been talking for the last almost hour with you about the importance of investing in teachers' learning. Well, then you might say, Len, what is the professional development budget of teachers across the country? And the reality is that the annual amount spent on professional development, while there's many different estimates, is very high. Millions and millions of dollars every year is spent on professional development, and I mean like hundreds of millions. So why does that not have a positive outcome? Well, a lot of the investments we put in are into programs that are well-intentioned but unsuccessful. So there is absolutely a resource challenge, and yet there's also a lot of room to grow in how we make the investment. Another thing that we can't talk about when we talk about education, we cannot ignore, is the realities of the rest of our social safety net in this country. And poverty and racism are absolutely factors that inhibit teachers' ability to work effectively with their students. When Finland is often used as a country that is an educational utopia, and they do in fact have a lot of smart policies that support teachers, support their learning, support students, but when the engineer of Finland's education turnaround was asked in a talk recently that I attended, what was the single most important factor that led to all these changes? He said, instead of any of those educational interventions, he said the factor was the election of more women into office. And why?
Why?
What was like important about that, besides women just obviously being great? He said it was that women in office pushed for a stronger social safety net in Finland. And what that allowed was for teachers to come to school, and all they had to do was work on the academic challenge at hand, the interpersonal challenge at hand, but not the challenge of feeding, clothing, providing for health services for their students, providing for mental health services. Similarly in this country, or not similarly in this country, mm-hmm. we do not provide those services well in this country. I mean, we know this. And so teachers come to school and they face a real moral dilemma. If you're in a school where your students are mostly living in poverty, do not have access to reliable or high quality health care, do not have access to mental health services, even though their surroundings and their environment may make them more susceptible to challenging mental health challenges, then you as a teacher face the dilemma of what are you going to invest your time in? Are you going to focus on teaching the students to read Upton Sinclair and have a lifelong love of literature? Or are you going to spend your time instead making sure that they have had breakfast, that they have somebody at home? You're going to stay after school with them, making sure they have an adult to talk to instead of working on your lesson plan for them the next day. These are real choices that teachers face every day in this country, and we are not making it easy for them to answer those questions.
No, we're not. So in your last 30 seconds, your optimism is based on?
There are so many people who are working on this problem. I mean, ultimately, the solution is to treat teaching the way it is. And I can only say that sentence to you because the last 20 years have produced both researchers and practitioners who have made it abundantly clear what teaching well takes and who are actively building all the components of a system that would be a better system for the American school children, school teachers. And, you know, as we start another school year, we have to salute those people who are working so hard to build that. And I think we'll only see them succeed more and more in the coming years.
Well, we want to thank journalist and author Elizabeth Green. She's the co-founder, CEO, and editor-in-chief of the nonprofit education news network Chalkbeat.org. She's written Building a Better Teacher, How Teaching Works, and How to Teach It to Everyone, which just came out in paperback, and the website is buildingabetterteacher.com. Elizabeth Green, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
It was our pleasure.
And that wraps up today's edition. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get to. Our program was produced by Richard Ive, technical direction from Peter J. Check out our website, WLRN.org, where we have free audio archives of our programs. Follow the radio, then the topical currents links. We also have links, photos, and more at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop us a like. Tomorrow at 1, Bonnie and I return with a Barnard College student who was a victim of bullying because she was overweight, but also then became a bully herself. She's recanted and now campaigns against the demeaning practice. Also with us, Miami-Dade Public Schools crisis team member Frank Zanere. This is Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.